Lawrence of Arabia, Spectacania, Sultan, John Glenn, Dredd. British politician, sex, JFK, blown away. What else do we have to say?
Okay. Now I can explain to Jeff why I hate this song so much.
Okay, I'm gonna, just so you know, I'm gonna crop off some of the failed lead in there, right? And we'll just go to the where I wanted to come in. So, but anyway,
okay, all right.
Afterwards, again, this is behind the scenes, behind
you
the
never,
music.
You never cut a post show or a pre show. What are you talking about? You won't do that.
I might.
No, you won't.
You never know.
No, you
always
won't.
A first.
Bullshit.
And I have in the past. You shouldn't say never. I was meticulous before I had kids.
Not in the pre and post shows.
Oh, yes, I was. Meticulous.
Well, you have kids, and you're trying to balance my dyes on each other. Okay, why do I hate this song so much? Because it's a celebration of baby boomers' lives. Because that's all it is. Because it's nothing more than, hey, we lived through this shit. I'm going to reference it. Because it's the epic movie of songs. That's all it is. I'm going to reference shit, and you'll remember it, and that's why you'll like this song. Ain't right, huh? Huh? That's why I hate this fucking song.
Until they write one for you.
Maybe if they write one for me, I will appreciate it. But I choose to think that I am far too cynical for that to work.
We are far too cynical for that to work. But that's right. That's right. The Gen almost wires.
Like, you know, Nirvana, 9/11.
Well, let's see.
Transformers, GoBots.
Lockerbie. You know, like anything before like what 85?
Banana
is...
Republic.
There you go. Yes, Transformers, GoBots, Banana Republic, Nirvana. We didn't start the ice bath.
We didn't start global warming. No, yeah, it's, we live in an age that's far too cynical for that song to work. But the baby boomers love it because they love thinking of themselves as important.
The generation after the greatest.
Mm-hmm. The generation that's destroying Social Security in the U.S. You know, it's...
But there's a lot of people to buy records when they still bought records.
Yeah, no, it, absolutely. It's a brilliant and cynical song. For a bunch of people who...
It's a horrible song, too.
It's an awful, it's awful song.
Horribly constructed song.
Yeah.
It's... The refrain is fingernails up a chalkboard for me. Oh, it's like, why can't the refrain be just a little bit better?
What is the point of the song? It's referencing a bunch of events that they remember and then saying, we didn't... start history. History was going on before we were doing.
Well,
but we witnessed some of it.
Does it say that, or does it say? So here, I'm going to be uncynical for a moment, just a moment.
Okay, try.
We didn't start the fire,
right?
So like all the problems that seem huge today are not new, and aren't huge, and we'll get I don't want to say we'll get worked out, but you get where I'm coming from.
No.
Like,
I mean,
like,
yes, like but I don't think that's
like
the
sequester,
point of the song.
Like the sequester, you know, is.
I don't think that's the point of the song.
Okay. Well, the point of the song is to sell something that baby boomers will pump their fists to. Is what it's for. That's the point of the song. We're not talking about the point of the song.
Yeah,
we're talking about
Ho Chi Minh and JFK getting blown away and Beatlemania and whatever the fuck else this thing references.
British politician sex.
Yeah, that scandal thing that they made a movie about that I rented because I wanted to masturbate to something and there wasn't any naked chicks in it.
Well, that's a horrible rental.
I know. But the poster was... Let me show you the poster.
Did you have HBO as a kid?
Oh, sure.
Did you, like, stay up late Saturday nights and looking at the TV guide trying to find out which shows had nudity? Like, oh, at 2:30, there's a show, the movie with nudity, and I can't wait to see the boobies.
I was...
Like, I would tell my mom, oh, I'm going to watch Saturday Night Live. And then as soon as they'd go to sleep, I'd flip over to HBO, and I would just wait and wait and wait and wait for the boobies. You know, Max will never have to do that.
No, it's true.
Max will have boobies on demand.
Oh, God. The way we've advanced has completely changed the way we look at porn. But look at that. If you saw that in a video store, would you not think there's going to be some sex going on? There's going to be some nice shit going on. I mean, it's covered, so it's not kind totally of scandalous.
Sort of. It also looks kind of like Susan Sarandon to me, so I'm liking, like, not sex, but...
Okay, well...
So, the reason I brought the whole HBO thing up, there's this one movie, I have no idea the name. It was this horror movie, you know, a gratuitous horror movie with lots of boobies in it, right? Uh-huh. And the girl was kind of possessed. She has her lipstick out, and she's drawing lipsticks on her tit, and she pushes it into, like, the lipstick disappears, like, into her nipple as she pushes the whole thing in. Like, I don't know. That scene just
that's gotta
sticks
mess you
with,
up.
That scene just sticks with you. Anyone knows what that movie is, let me know.
I had the advantage of we got Spice Channel, but it was scrambled. But that was okay when you're 13, 14. You didn't mind. You heard people having sex. You could vaguely see what's going on. The way they scrambled, it was an analog scramble, so it was not...
I remember trying to... Well, that, you know, I was... I like. Someone gave me plans in middle school on how to write a descrambler, and you needed to come up with this this variable capacitor. I don't know if it exists. I haven't looked to see if it exists since I was an adult, right? But it's like, all the other parts were super simple. It was a circuit I could have made, you know, because I was I actually took electronics class, you know? So, like, it was a circuit I could have made, except for this variable capacitor. And I never looked into it. You know, never really tried to look into...
That's what the internet is for. Variable capacitor, Wikipedia. There are a bunch of them, yeah. But that was a hard... Capacitance may be intentionally and repeatedly changed mechanically or electronically.
Yeah, so basically you had to tune that to unscramble. Mm-hmm. At least that's the story I remember.
That makes sense.
But, you know, instead of a resistor, you know, like a pot, a potentiometer is a variable resistor. You turn the knob, changes the resistance. Changing the amount of capacitance.
Yeah. But again, not as trivial. Like Jeff was saying, now it'd be easy to... Amazon or Geek, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Variable capacitor, where can I buy it? Boom, 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 buy. Ship
well, there's that. There's buy the gray market thing that scrambles your cable. Could you imagine today's marketplace and defeating old-time cable scrambling? Exactly.
Yeah. It's easy. I mean,
like I'm sure, like, if I had the whereabouts of subscribing to 2600, you know, back in the early 90s, I could have mail ordered a cable descrambler.
Absolutely.
You know, but I didn't have the whereabouts of that at that point.
Yeah, the world has changed significantly. That's, like I said before, okay, baby boomers, their big contribution to America has been a huge degrading of the economy. Thanks. Making, you know, a huge degrading of the amount of wealth that people get, except for a very tiny point. A huge degrading of the social system. Thanks, but I guess that's kind of not your fault. There are just a lot of babies that were made, and okay. And the ridiculous politics we find ourselves under is mostly baby boomers. And what's our legacy as the generation before or generation after Generation X, which was... So Generation X was like Nirvana and the, you know, ironic stuff and cynicism.
No, Generation X was more 80s, like before.
Nirvana was sort of maybe tail Nirvana end that was sort of like crossed
the,
both.
Maybe Nirvana was like the tail end, the twilight of Generation X. Yeah. You know, but like if you're tied to, you know, born and bred Generation X, you know, you're
Devo, you know, you
well, you're that, or you're Poison and Motley Crue, you know.
Yeah, and in terms of, you know, okay, in terms of cultural things, like what's that movie with Ben Stiller and Janine Garofalo?
I don't.
They're actually a couple.
Yeah, there's the superhero one. They were both in the superhero one.
But the Winona Ryder one, Winona Ryder and. Ethan Hawke.
What's that, like Girls in Cars?
No, no, God. It was a shitty movie, but it was one that they all loved. and Breakfast Club, you know, those kind of things. And
well, we've already talked how we've been. Yeah. We have our you and me don't have a label. You know, we're not Gen Y, we're not Gen X.
Yeah, but we are the generation that made the internet.
Yeah, we've talked about that too. So
that is our legacy. And as far as I'm concerned, our legacy has.
Are we really the generation? No, we're not. Okay, so what do you mean made the internet? Because.
No, it's the next generation that took what we made and turned it into the commercial success.
But we weren't the researchers and the scientists that invented the internet. We were too young for that.
We were the people who made it into something that could be turned
into commercial. We were the people that said, hey, Tim Berners-Lee made Netscape. Let's make stupid-ass websites Ass Master Pennsylvania. And,
right.
Okay.
Yeah. We started the internet economy that other people came and took over.
We toiled in the mines for the first flood of web pages and things.
About the first decade of internet stuff was us. And then,
well,
you know,
we weren't the managers. We were the people toiling
right,
in the mines.
We were the people who were... Yeah, exactly. But that's okay because the managers are the ones who were treating it like a normal business and we were treating it like it was a toy. And then people came around and said, well, what if we took this toy and turned it into something useful? Then you get the people like Zuckerberg, and that's the next generation, who said, hey, I can connect people to other people and make a lot of money off of this.
I don't know if I agree with that. I more so see the, you know, the internet as you're describing it as coming of age, you know, we were a little too immature. We weren't making, our generation wasn't making the decisions at that point. Maybe the people like Mark Zuckerberg, or better yet, who's the previous generation of Sergey Brin, you know, the Google guys, the PayPal guys, the geniuses of our generation, right? But for you and me, it took a few
Jeff
more
Bezos.
Years. He's older. I mean,
slightly, but I mean.
But for you, I'm saying for you and me, it took another few years for us to get to the point where we saw things clearly.
Segway, that would be in our song. The Segway scooter.
Segway?
Teen Cayman, blown away. What else are we going to say? Osama bin Laden, blown away.
Let's go out and cheer.
damn it. You made me think, you made me lose my thought. Okay, you were talking about, fuck, it was a good digression I had. Oh, okay, I remember. So he had all these movies and he had these, so We Didn't Start a Fire is a song that's sort of tailor-made for that.
Mm-hmm.
You told me about it and I just recently watched Wreck-It Ralph.
Okay. Yeah.
That's a movie that's made for us.
Yeah, you're
that's
right.
That's a movie
the video games are like very, because they go back as far as, I mean.
This Rampage is essentially what they were.
Well, there's Rampage, the racer guy, the villain.
That's,
I guess that was just an arcade game. I mean, but like, cause it really is an equivalent console that kind of, it was after Atari, it was before,
There was a game sort of like, I think it was called Knight Rider. But not like the Knight Rider
but
TV
show. But like home console, I'm not sure if that...
Or Pole Position was kind of sort of, those graphics were sort of similar to it.
It was worse than Pole Position. It was worse than NES. It was better than 2600.
Yeah.
And there wasn't a commercial...
A television.
There wasn't a commercial success between those two consoles, was there?
There wasn't a huge commercial...
Maybe it was ColecoVision. Yeah. You know. But yeah, certainly... yeah, Wreck-It Ralph was fun. There was a lot of nostalgia, you know, up to Halo type stuff in there.
Yeah, that was a movie that was made by our generation. There's no question about it because the references, the stuff that they brought up, and you know they wrenched in some older ones like Q-Bert and Pac-Man, which were slightly before our time, but which we still definitely knew about. You were dropping my dice.
That was
your attempt to
was a neutrino hitting the dice.
Your attempt to
I didn't do anything. That was a neutrino. Came in, boom.
I
hit the
broke
dice.
A bottle, you dropped my dice. It all evens out.
Only one fell off the table.
This is a
new
this
podcast.
Is my pouch.
New. I saw that.
Look at the inside, though. The inside's velvet.
It was nice. On the Twitter thing. Yeah. Or on the Amazon thing. I saw you bought a pouch.
Yeah.
You should have bought a kangaroo scrotum pouch. There's no seams.
Can you get that on Amazon?
You probably can. In Scouts, Scoutmaster had to work in Australia for a year, and he came back, and he one of the Toskis he brought his son was a kangaroo scrotum pouch. No seams.
Wow.
That's a nice ding.
That's a hell of a ding.
Yep. Anyway, I got two notes here. New podcast that I have to highly recommend. Just found it today. I think it's called Still Untitled. It's the Adam Savage podcast. Have you seen this one?
Is that the one he does on Tested.com?
Yeah, that one.
I've not really, because every time I go to Tested.com and I think they're going to do something, he's going to do something interesting, it's more like, let's take apart this piece of equipment. And that's not interesting.
Oh, see, I'm not too familiar with Tested, but the Adam Savage, I've listened to.
Or it's Adam saying, here's how I made this piece of equipment from Blade Runner. It's like, okay, I don't fucking care.
I listened to the newest ones about work ethic and you should play this to, like, every kid in high school. Like, you know, like, you don't learn shit in the shit you learn in college, sure, it teaches your brain how to do things, but you don't have any, you know, you need to put in the work and do things. And it was a really good podcast. And I listened to, what was the other one about? It was, I don't know, I enjoyed it.
I agree with that sentiment in the sense that, you know, I've seen people come right out of college try to, I was at a job where they hired this guy who was right out of college. He went to CMU, very bright guy. Undergrad, did a computer science, then did a graduate in computer science. Like 22, 23 years old. Very bright, very young. Could not program for the business at all. Why? Because he thought of everything as a school project. And a school project, you never get moving goalposts. You never get people telling you.
You don't have to maintain it after.
Yeah, this needs to be maintained. Right. Yes. You never get people saying, okay, you need to make options so this can be extended. No, it was everything he made was compressed and turned into this little thing that then it was impenetrable. It worked. It did what it was supposed to do. But if you wanted to upgrade it, if you wanted to change how it worked, it was fucking impenetrable.
Mm-hmm.
He was, you know, he loved it. He was very impressed. And it was an
impressive
piece of work.
I've come to realization recently, and maybe it's because I have a minion now, a good minion, and a really good minion. Like, you can say, here's what I need you to do. And he doesn't know how to do it, but he can figure it out. Uh-huh. He takes time to do it. It's really well. But the one thing that he doesn't get yet, the main thing that I keep having to describe is everything we do, I got to be careful how you say this because it almost sounds like you're a government bureaucrat, you know, but trying to run a lean elite team, everything you do, you have to consider about the maintenance implications of it. You know, you just can't do one-offs. If you do a one-off, you have to figure out how you're going to maintain that for the next 5 to 7 years, mm-hmm. You know. And it took me a while. It took me a long time, maybe up to even getting into my current company, to really get the whole maintenance thing. Running IT for a startup by yourself, you learn the maintenance part of it.
Well, I know
you can't be running all over the place not knowing how to maintain things.
Yeah. So a good example of that is Jeff and I kind of, you know, split off at a point where, you know, we were in web design and we both then split off in different directions. Jeff split off into sort of the IT
sysadmin.
In sysadmin part, and I split off into sort of application design. And what I'm doing now in application design, you know, a lot of it is designing the data flow and really designing a database, figuring out how to get this database, kind of make the right database for this particular product. And yeah, 10 years ago, I would not have known how to do it. And 5 years ago, I would have been worse at it. But now, you know, I know, okay, this is probably something that we're going to need to update and change. This should be this needs to be its own separate table. This needs a link to this. These things need to be primary keys. These things have to be associated with each other. This should not be in code. This should be in code to figure out what, you know, and you only get that. You really only get that from experience.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it's not those kinds of things. It's more like, you know, someone's asking for something that I could have set up for them in an hour and a half. In 90 minutes, I could have it set up. But I need to document it. I need the plan for how to maintain it, right. You know? So it's actually a week project, you know? So like when I'm talking to the new guy, you know, it's like, I hopefully he's understanding, you know, that I'm not just saying no because I want to say no. I'm saying no to things because the burden of maintenance is not worth it. You know, like, let's look at other options. Let's look at, how about this option?
I'll give you a trivial example. Like for one of my projects, we have to keep track of who is in graphics so that we can assign something to them. And probably when I was first programming, I would just put that in the code. Who's in graphics, there's the assign. Now I know I'm going to make a table with people in graphics so we can always search this, and I can update and remove things from that table at will. That's the kind of thing that it seems obvious, but it's one of the things you wouldn't think about had you not had the experience to do that.
Yep. So the Adam Savage podcast, especially the one about, if you're a young guy just out of college, young person just out of college, listen to the work ethic
thing. You're listening to a craft beer radio post show.
Listen to the work ethic one. It was
so for all two of you.
yeah, exactly. I was kind of like, yes, I agree with everything he has to say here. You know, he's surprised at how many people want to work for M5 or the Mythbusters, and they're just slackers. Yeah. They're not, you know, and
those guys do a fuck ton of work.
It should be obvious that if you're going to work for a popular TV show, the competition for a position is going to be ridiculous, and B, you're going to be doing cool stuff, but you have to work your ass off, you know? And he says, you know, they'll get people in, you know, like it's happened. Of course he didn't name names, but you know, it's happened where they've had, you know, production assistants in and whatnot. And he's like, you know, it's just like, he's talking about one time when he was at ILM, they sent someone, was it ILM? I think it was ILM. They sent, you know, one of the new kind of just contracted help out, like per job help out, and like to do some kind of spray painting on like 75 different things. And she came back and like said, "I'm done." And like, "Wow, you're done already? It totally took like 45 minutes." Like, "Well, I didn't do them all. I did as many as I'm going to do in the job. You know, what else do you have for me? I'm done with that job." Like, you can go home is what you can do. You know, it's like, who thinks that's a good idea? Like, this is beneath me. I'm not going to finish this task. What else do you have for me?
I think that
you can go home and not collect a paycheck.
He's at a disadvantage because people are interested in working for him because they see on the show. It seems like fun, and B, it lasts 12 seconds, the view of them building something. So somebody, you know, reasonably may extrapolate from that, they showed 12 seconds, it probably took them 4 or 5 hours. They don't think, that 12 seconds is the compression of 4 days of work.
Yeah. He was talking about someone he had interviewed at, someone in the industry, where like, you know, people coming in, they show them their art portfolios, you know, because they're making special effects type stuff. Mm-hmm. He's like, "I don't want to see your art portfolios because I don't know how close what you created was to what your intention was. I don't know what your intention was. Mm-hmm. I want you to create me a replica of a 57 Chevy. So I know what a 57 Chevy is, and I can tell how good of a job you did, right?" You know, that's kind of an interesting idea, too. Your portfolio should be, you know, "I tried to do this. You know what this is. Mm-hmm. And here's what I came up with." You know, I mean, that's helpful for almost anyone in any industry, right? Like, interviewing with stuff. Like, does that equate to what you're showing people? You know?
That is not unlike what I do when I'm interviewed, is that I explain what I have done that's similar to things that people may have done. Like I've made a fax Ajax application that had its own address book that was similar to Outlook in the way you could function. So I've done that. Now, unfortunately, I couldn't show the code because it's all. Mm-hmm. But I could explain.
You don't own the code.
Yeah, I don't own the code. Yeah. But I could explain how, you know, how I wrote it and what I did and say, you know, I've done this, I've done that. So the things that people can understand and, you know, can latch on to. This is what I've made databases for this type of application. Right.
I mean, in that creative industry, it's a little bit different. There are portfolios. But, yeah, like, I mean, but make something that so that everyone's familiar with, you know, and show how meticulous it is, you know. Okay, so you don't want to make a 57 Chevy. Make an AT-AT. Right? Make a replica of an AT-AT. You know, that could be fun. And most, you know, hiring managers of creative companies will know what an AT-AT is, you know? So go from there. I was watching some TED Talks recently. What's your general opinion of TED?
My general opinion of TED is that it's an overinflated kind of self-celebratory thing. That, similar to the Billy Joel song, I take a very cynical view of.
Okay.
And I distrust a 20-minute talk about a complicated subject.
Okay. I understand that. A couple, you know, majority of the ones I had watched were actually about schooling, education, you know, things like that. And, you know, some really interesting points that came up is that it's almost like the one thing that, like, I thought was most interesting, and I'm curious what school's going to be like for my kids when, you know, they're going through school. It kind of flip-flops the in-classroom and homework sections. Some teachers are.
Well, I told you about that.
I told
you about, well, we actually, it was during the Miracle Fruit.
Okay.
It's extravaganza. So I
vaguely remember that.
Yeah, now. I probably didn't, you know.
And food was primary.
Yeah.
But
it was
so,
classroom flipping with the idea that the lectures are done at home with on a podcast or a video, and then the homework is done at school.
Yes. The homeworks, the labs, the interaction, the engagement is done at school. And not only that, but a good video person on YouTube, it will be able to make the content more engaging.
Right.
Like I watched a TED Talk about a guy talking about making science education fun. And his segment was talking about how viruses attack bacteria. You know, and he showed how it's written in the literature about a bacteriophage, blah, 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 all kinds of big words, very boring. And, you know, and he used his methods where, you know, they have secret agents that insert DNA and when there's, you know, like it's kind of the, well, you got to listen to his talk, right? Because
Before you get into it, let me explain why Jeff responded that way to me, because people didn't see my look was a very quizzical look when Jeff said that. And the reason why I had a quizzical look was I was thinking to myself, if you make these analogies, that's a poor way to teach because these analogies are not perfect and they require.
They're not perfect. So here's the argument.
Okay.
Teaching high school kids. Would you rather them be bored out of their mind about learning science that's completely accurate? Or would you rather have them be set up to maybe. It's that whole, remember, like when we learned chemistry in school, right? We learned atoms and shells and stuff wrong the first time. And a couple years later, we learned it right. Yeah. You know, so what is wrong about teaching people from a storytelling level how it's happening, an engaging manner of this stuff? And I agree with this kid, the guy, where it gets storytelling. Greg pulled up the storytelling thing in the pre-show, but you know, so he's big about, you know, like he made, like the story he told was this whole virus bacteria thing was a horror story. You know, the bacterias were getting ripped apart like Alien, and the viruses are coming out and stuff. And what's wrong with
the best way
science to make, in high school?
Look, there's a reason why this works. the best way to understand something is a story. Sure. And so you're absolutely right. You're
what's
absolutely
wrong right. with making high school science an introduction to concepts?
Nothing. You're absolutely right. And I feel kind of ashamed of myself for kind of poo-pooing it because you're right on all the points there. It's about bringing them
they're
in
not gonna,
so you can teach right. them more.
They're not going to be working on their PhD
right.
in thinking that all viruses have DNA when they have RNA or something, right?
Right.
Because one of the points was, you know, like he showed what was in the literature, and he showed what he would want to write, and he kind of showed, like, the edits, and, like, this is not 100% correct, and you can't call it DNA, we'll call it virus nucleic acid. And, you know, it from a one sentence that made a lot of sense to everyone listening, to the sentence that even if you and I stopped to read it, it wouldn't be as impactful, even right. though it was technically yeah. correct. And what's wrong with teaching high school kids?
No, it's a really good point.
Or even freshmen in college, right? But, yeah. but particularly high yeah. school kids.
No, it's a really good point. It really is. I have no argument against that. The explanation you gave really hit home. It really did. That because you're exactly right. We teach things simply, and then we expand if people are really interested in going into it.
Right.
Yeah, it's
right.
not quite like that.
Yeah,
it's not quite like that either. Yeah.
Well, he had a whole point, part of his speech about, you know, I'm not advocating dumbing down science. And it was basically that. People that are going to be interested, get more people interested, mm-hmm. they might drop out later, but... You know, just have this expectation. This isn't, I don't know. You don't tell them this isn't exactly accurate, but you know, have the expectation that there's more to it than this.
So have I?
But this is how it works.
Explain why I think this is not just about movies and TV and ancient yeah. literature, but why this is about everything.
No, I mean, I think it's pretty clear to me why it's about everything, especially after watching this particular TED Talk, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he made a story, and I don't know if it had all 8 points of that, but he made a story that would be definitely engaging to high school uh-huh. kids. I mean, it's about bad viruses destroying bacteria, right. which are also, could be bad, could be good, whatever. But
my point is, you know, I've said earlier, language is a technology that we've developed, and then we advanced to a new technology, which was written language. And we had these stories that we started to then write down and then disseminate more to people. And that's one reason about 10,000 years ago why we started to get better and better civilizations. And we had these stories for explaining things, and mm-hmm. they worked reasonably well. And so civilization progressed reasonably well. And then... what happened is ultimately in about, 400 years ago, and Bacon came along and codified the laws of science to fit with the story. It fits exactly into the story method. You have, you are at point one. You have your basic, who are you? You're the body of scientific knowledge. At number two, well... okay, so this is number two, is where you have a need. I want to figure out something, how mm-hmm. something works.
Right.
Number three is where you go. Okay, I want to figure out how this works. I have an experiment, an idea to test this. Number four, that's where you do the search. This is where you're doing your testing. You're testing your experiment. Number five, this is your meeting with the goddess. You've accomplished your goal. You have done your experiment. You have your results. Number six, your atonement with the father.
Peer review.
You're comparing your results to what you expected. Mm-hmm. This is when the ultimate challenge happens. This is when you see whether your results match what sure. you thought.
But for scientists, that's weird.
Yeah.
It's just as
yeah.
good as that's exactly what you thought.
Seven. Okay, you've got your results. Now you're going to return back and you're going to examine them and figure out them in light of theory. And finally, in eight, this is when you've returned. You see whether you have to adjust your theory or not, whether your hypothesis was real or not. This is a story. A big technological advantage was figuring out how to turn our understanding of the world into a story. And once we did that, our productivity and our engagement with the world shot up in a ridiculous fashion, in a level unseen before. Why? Because somebody managed to figure out how to make this into a story. We see everything as stories. And science is a story in itself. And that is why everything has, that's why science is so powerful. Not because science is some amazing, different way of looking at things. No, it's because it's actually the same way of looking at things, but it's just adapted very strongly to this way.
I saw an awesome, a really cool TED Talk where, awesome, trying to throw a word. It was about, scientist was working with a school in England. Benton Bees? You've heard about this one?
Not sure.
The kids came up with a pretty unique experiment about bees, where if they could condition them, like certain, like they had patterns in the flowers or colored circles, and only certain ones gave reward, right? Mm-hmm. And they did the experiments, and the scientist helped them write a paper, and you know, it got rejected because it was written, like, it started with "once upon a time," you know, it was kids had written the paper, right? But it was rigorous and everything, and the kid got rejected by it wasn't Nature, I forget,
physical who. Letters science
might have been that one.
Okay.
And then so the scientists had it peer reviewed by a couple other scientists, and the scientists gave it rave reviews. You know, like neurobiologists gave it rave reviews, and they finally got it published, and they're like the youngest kids ever have a published paper. And I don't know, it was just really, it was interesting, like how the establishment, you know, poo-pooed the paper because of the way it was written. Because, you know, the scientist was helping them, you know, was their mentor, I guess, and then helped them prepare the paper, you know, didn't take out the kidness of it, even though the science was still rigorous. And it was a very cool TED Talk, for sure.
And, well, I mean, it's ultimately cool. It shows the value of peer review, and that when they gave it to peer review, it was rejected at first, but then people sort of see the light of day, and it's hard to see the science.
The Blackton Bees. You can look that up Blackton if you're bees. Curious. Yeah. It's the journal that it finally got published in, which was published online December 22nd, 2010. What journal is it in? I guess it's the... Oh, Biology Letters.
Okay.
It's the only paper that will always be free on Biology Letters, I guess, you know, because of the kids and things like that. But it was a really interesting talk about the whole thing. And I don't think I've told you this. Was it 2 weekends ago? Ellie and Max were running experiments. We filled up a big tub of water, and we got a bunch of things, and we had to hypothesize if they'd float or not.
Cool.
So Ellie would take a certain thing, like, will this float? Yeah, I think it'll float. I'll put it in. You know, she was surprised by some things and whatnot. So, you know, I was just trying to get the scientific method.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just a little exposure to scientific method. Will it float? You know, David Letterman, you know, do it on,
right, yeah,
on his show. Same kind of thing, you know, and Max loved it. Max was grabbing all kinds of things. You know, we had to keep a really close eye to make sure he wasn't throwing iPhones into the tub, right, or anything. Yeah. But they loved, you know, Ellie liked it, and Max just loved throwing things in the water and seeing if they'd float. But, you know, at his age, it's kind of like throwing the spoon on the floor, you know? I mean, infants do throw the spoon on the floor. For him, it was
a point that's kind of implicit in this model is that it doesn't have to be slow. Each of these steps doesn't have to necessarily take time. You could essentially skip some of these because they're implied. But as long as you land on the right points,
mm-hmm,
You're telling a reasonable story.
Yeah. I mean, the only point that I wanted to enforce with Allison, and I made sure we slowed down, was what's your prediction?
Yeah.
You know, instead of just throw everything in the tub of water and see what floats and what doesn't, let's look at the object. Let's analyze it and figure out if we think it'll float or not.
And Allie's too young to understand why it doesn't, you know, what density and that sort of stuff. But
I tried to show her, you know, buoyancy displacement. She probably didn't get it. But I'm like, look, here's a plate. If we put it in edge first, sinks right away. If we sit it on the water, it floats. You know, I just wanted to show her that strange behavior, right? Right. I told her.
Well, that's more surface tension, isn't it?
No, it's buoyancy. It's the placement of water. It's not surface tension when the thing weighs a pound.
but you're spreading it apart across. It's the same thing. But it's the same thing as snowshoes, right? It's the idea that you're, you know, even though it weighs the same, if you spread it out over a larger distance, then it's not going to sink as easily. You're not putting as much pressure.
No, it's not the same thing as snowshoes because snow doesn't flow in over the edges. Like, you can have some snow come out on top of the snowshoe, and it doesn't all flow in.
That has to do with the viscosity of snow. But you can do similar.
So, snowshoes, does that come down to displacement? Because for water, an aircraft carrier floats because it displaces more. The water that it displaces weighs more than the aircraft carrier.
Right. Yeah.
That's why it floats. You know, the plate floated because the weight of the water it displaced weighs more than the plate.
Right.
That's not surface tension.
No, you're right. You're right.
Now, snowshoes, I'm not sure
That's about distribution of weight as well. It's not surface tension, but it's about distribution.
But is it displacement or is it something
else? It's about distribution, not displacement. It's the same reason why people can sleep on bed of nails and not hurt themselves.
Right. So that is...
As weight distribution. Yeah.
That's not displacement. So it's not the same as the plate.
Yeah.
So I showed her those things. I didn't expect her to retain that. But like I said, you know, the main part, my motivation, it's fun. But my thing was, let's not just throw a bunch of stuff in the water. Let's look at the item. Let's predict. Mm-hmm. We wrote them down. Crayon, will it float? Her prediction and the result, you know.
It should float. Crayon should float.
Crayon does not float.
Really?
Crayon only floats when the paper's dry. The paper gets wet, the crayon sinks.
I can see that. Sure. I thought that crayon might be more porous.
No, the crayon floated when the paper was dry. As soon as the paper got wet, it sank.
Okay.
Pencils, obviously.
You mean something? Yeah. Okay. So pencil should float as wood. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Pencils.
Let me try to predict. What other else should try?
I'm trying to think. You know, there wasn't too many other there was like plastic spoon and metal spoon.
Right? Yes, the metal spoon will sink, the plastic spoon will float.
Right. Once we got, like, she has some Scholastic Curious George books, and they have different experiments in the back. And this one, that's where I got the idea about this whole floating or not floating thing. And they had some basic ideas, but you know, after that the kids are like, let's try more things. I'm like, as long as it doesn't take batteries, you can try it. You know, so we floated a whole bunch of stuff. I can't think of any other things, you know, to quiz you about. The crayon, I didn't know the answer for the crayon, actually.
Yeah,
you know?
that's kind of surprised me, because I
would have thought a crayon would float, actually.
I bet it would float in an ocean with more in a salt water.
Probably.
Yeah.
Yeah, the crayon was almost neutral, but yeah, once the paper was wet, or once you took the paper off, it definitely sank.
But like, you know how in the Dead Sea it's so salty, people can float. Yeah. I figure that a crayon would probably
float in salt water, in the ocean water. I'm trying to think what else was. I think that was really the only one that I would have predicted wrong. I mean, because a crayon seems like there's a fair amount of air. When you crack one, you see air holes and stuff. Mm-hmm,
exactly. That's why I thought, okay, that'll float.
Yep. No, they sink.
Interesting. Interesting. But stupid.
I'm trying to think.
Yeah. There's a baby boomer reference. It's a laugh-in reference.
Then I also, for Allie, I've made some circuit blocks where I have blocks of wood with some terminals on it, and one has a motor mounted to it and one has a light bulb. So, like, she still needs some help figuring out how to actually complete the circuit. Like, I try to say, make a circle, connect them all through. If she does the battery in the motor, she gets it. If we try to throw a switch in there, you know, she doesn't get it yet.
Yeah, so. I had a weird situation where, okay, so I had to try to explain to Ava, who's my 8-year-old niece, on the phone, first why operation worked, and try to explain, well, you're completing a circuit. What does that mean exactly? And that's a hard thing to explain. But then she asked, why do clouds float if they have all that water in them? And that's really a more complicated question. It has to do with density and, you know, the area that it's actually extended over. And
Wait till you tell her, like, the mass of all the water suspended in the air around the globe.
Yeah.
Ooh, it's a crazy number.
It's a crazy number, but the Earth is crazy big, so that's why it's... And you have to, you know, you have to consider the effects of being that high in the atmosphere. And, yeah, so it was a hard thing to explain because, to be honest, I don't understand it completely. So how am I going to explain it to my 8-year-old niece if I don't understand it completely? I understand how the operation works. That I get. But, so that was a little bit hard to explain to an 8-year-old. I could explain
it has a lot to do with the phase change, right? Because water vapor is gaseous instead of, you know, so... But, you know, water's a crazy chemical, right?
If you were to take all the water in a cloud and put it down, it'd be pretty heavy. But since it's spread over such a large area of distance, it isn't quite as heavy. It's spreading stuff out. It's the same.
Yeah, but it's not like it's tiny drops of water. It's vapor, right?
Yeah.
It's not.
To get an idea of how diffuse it is, fog is essentially the same thing. And fog is this really diffuse thing, and you can sort of see, okay, that's sort of what a cloud is on the ground.
It's a good question, though.
Yeah, it is a really good question.
Good question she asked, because she realized clouds should be heavy.
Yeah.
And you should say, yes, clouds are heavy, but...
Yeah. It's a tough one to answer, but I'm pleased that she's asking the question.
Well, exactly. Clouds are heavy, but what I'm going to tell you is not intuitive. Mm-hmm. That's the answer, right? You're right. That's an excellent question. And you are definitely right. But what you're failing to understand is that
it's a question of scale.
This whole cloud thing is not intuitive at all.
Yeah. And my sister, you know, explained, you know, he's right. You know, when you're on an airplane, you go through a cloud, you see how really big they are. And I thought that was good of her to pick that out. So, yeah, I mean.
Good experiment to show how much air weighs is take a ruler on a table. Spread out a piece of newspaper, like have the ruler off the edge of the table. Mm-hmm. Spread out a piece of newspaper on half the ruler and on the table, and hit the ruler, and the ruler will break, right? Because of the weight of the air on the newspaper will be spreading out the whole PSI thing. And
another experiment in that sort of vein is it's always hard to explain to people that air is a fluid, and they're immersed in this fluid, and that's why it doesn't feel like anything. And the best way to understand that, as far as I can think, is open an umbrella indoors and just sort of spin it around. You can really feel what you're moving around, and you can feel the pressure, you know, the intensity of the weight of stuff that you're moving around.
Yeah, that's a good one. Breaking a ruler would definitely be more impactful, though, you know?
Yeah. But you could feel, without breaking anything.
But find one of those cheap freebie, you know, balsa wood rulers, right? Yeah. And crack that one. But, you know, so that'd definitely be an experiment. You know, so when Allie asked me about clouds, I think that's the experiment I'm going to do for her. Sure. Like, here's how much air weighs. Mm-hmm. It's just like how that plate floats on top of water.
But then you have a difference because it's one of those other things. I mean, because you're simplifying it for her, but up there, air weighs less because there's less air pressure. And so there's.
If I can get my daughter interested in science, take a career in science. I mean, she's not, it's like, no, not retail. Retail's not where you want to work, you know? So, you know, I'm just going to foster as much as I can, and I'm going to stand exactly, but you just got into way too much. Get her interested in the ignorant explanation that is accurate enough. Mm-hmm. And yes, when you go to college, you will find that I lied to you, but you were interested in it. Yeah. And what is the
harm? I lied to you in the right direction.
What is the harm in this lie?
It's
more of an omission than a lie.
Yeah. No, you're right. It sticks in my craw in a weird way because I have this weird Asperger's thing where I feel like you gotta give me the real explanation, not the fake one, but I'm thinking about me, not thinking about her.
More,
and that's the problem.
More STEM engineering, you know, STEM students and professionals is what America needs.
America.
It's what the world needs, right? And if you're doing things to foster that. When you're not, they're not going to grow up thinking the earth is flat and like be a professional and say the earth is flat. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not going to think that, you know, that electrons are exactly right there. They're going to learn, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, so,
you know, I told my niece what I heard from Feynman, which is that the most important thing is not what did you learn in school today, but what questions did you ask today? Because
I forgot about that. I need to use that. I need to use that with my kids.
Because you know, that's what's important. What did you ask about? What were you interested in? What did you try to, you know, to learn about? Not what did you what were you forced to learn? What did they tell you? It's what did you ask? What questions did you ask? That's what's important. And so, yeah, that's why it pleased me to no end that that Ava was asking these questions. Even though I couldn't answer them, that's fine. Mm-hmm. If I can't answer them completely, that's not a problem. You know, that she's asking the question tells me that she's curious about what the heck's going on.
I mean, the only feedback I can give you is don't give her the... How old is she, 7?
8.
8. Dude, you could definitely give her the good enough for an 8-year-old question.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's hard because, like I said, I feel an urge.
Give her the good enough for a 14-year-old answer.
Yeah, I know.
And then you're giving her double the detail and she still might get it. You know?
I try. I really do. I try to get it to the point where, it's sort of like this. And, like, the operation was easier than the clouds one because, like I said, the clouds one I didn't understand. The operation one, it was, you know, it's like touching a battery to a light bulb. That's what you're doing. So it was...
Well, it's exactly what you're doing.
But it's also a buzzer. But, yeah, I mean, it's you're making a circle, right? So the operation one...
The new operation has circuitry in it where you can have it...
Oh, really?
You can have it be more lenient. Like for little kids like Allison.
Oh, that's cool.
So you put it on level 1 and like if you take the tweezers and go, it's not really lenient. You can't hold it on for like a second or anything. But if you like touch it to the mouth, like tap, 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 buzzer, like it won't light up. So they have some circuitry in there. You know, there's a capacitor in there.
Yeah, yeah.
That exactly. Gives you a little more leniency so kids can play it better. I'm not sure that it helps all that much because it's still not as lenient as I would have expected.
No.
Like, but it's not a half second, and I would have expected it to be at least a half second.
She wasn't asking about operation. Operation was the way
I
answered her question, which was about how does something work, and I said it was like the game Operation. So that was good. I think that was good. That was a good segue for me because then she knew how she knew operation, and she knew that, so she was able to use that to make a, you know, to compare the two. And but the clouds one was like, eesh, that's a really good question. I don't really know how to answer that one.
I'm gonna grab something. You can just go in here, so you can just talk for a sec.
Okay, I'm gonna roll a 100 sided die to see if Jeff will find his thing or not. The 100 head die rolls a 58, so Jeff is more likely than not to find it, but it's really no better than chance. Not really much better than chance. Maybe I'll roll again and see what happens here. And, okay, that's a 78. That's, yeah, that's pretty good. Jeff's going to find it.
Here it comes.
Okay.
But these are some of the circuit blocks I made for Allison.
So I figured these are big pieces of wood with nails in them, and
so we have battery pack here.
Okay,
we got some alligator clips.
Alligator clips to connect these to nails.
And so do you see what I made here?
So there's a paper clip here, so Jeff can complete and uncomplete the circuit at will,
or
basically a switch. Yes, and I can do that, and yes, the light turns on when I click the switch.
And it's modular, so here's another one.
That would be a motor that's attached to the two
so we move these alligator electrodes. Clips.
And then their wires go to a motor, and
Better for radio.
Yes.
The motor has this little offset circle thing on it. It's made to make it vibrate. So push down the paperclip to the nail. So yeah, so it's definitely my first electronic kit.
Mm-hmm.
Battery, homemade switch, where you can actually see the mechanics of the switch. And then, you know, I need to get a buzzer so I can have a buzzer to, even though this thing does buzz, I just want an audible buzzer that they can hook up to. So,
what's this other one here?
This is
it's like a transistor almost.
This is before I made so this is a momentary switch, right? Because you push down and it springs back up.
Right.
This is a single pull. Oh, okay. Double throw switch.
Okay, I see.
Right, so it goes one way. It's completely homemade. It's this little piece of metal on a screw, and you push it one way, it touches one nail. Push it the other way, it touches another nail. So it's a double throw switch. Single pull, double throw. So you could do some more circuits with that.
So you could turn it on.
If I had more jumpers here, when it's this way, the light would be lit up, and then when it's this way, the motor would be running. Mm-hmm. You know, you could change it that way.
That's clever.
So. Yeah, I made that before I made the momentary switch. And I realized the momentary switch is
a better demonstration tool.
Better demonstration tool, yeah. Here, electromagnet.
See, this is more complicated.
But the kids know how to use it. So you take the momentary switch, you hook it up to the electromagnet. Of course, we don't have any paper clips here or anything.
I can look at the...
All right, but it's more fun to pick things up.
Well...
Right.
I don't have to know that. I mean, I know that it will be attracted.
Right. So there we go. Yeah. So it well, it's just, you got to close the circuit for the magnet to turn on.
Okay. Yeah. That's attracted. It's harder to pull off.
Yep. So
it's easier to pull off.
So what do I got? I got light, I got motion, and I got magnetics in my little do-it-yourself.
That reminds me, and hold on a second, because I need to. Okay, so I have a friend, the same friend who actually got me this, who I have conversations with a lot about these sort of things. And he has a kind of mystical-esque view of certain things. I tried to explain to him, and he gets it, and I get him too. I mean, I get where he's coming from, but like we had a big conversation about philosophy. Oh, there you go. Your electromagnet will pick up... bottle caps and we'll release them. That's cool.
Yep.
So we had a conversation about philosophy and my, you know, one of my first principles is that reality exists and his is, well, I'm not sure about that. So, there's obviously a disconnection there, but he, and actually not necessarily him, but, other people that I've conversed with have said things like, Energy has a knowledge to it, or do you really think that energy is just dumb, that's all it is? And my big point here is that whoever it is I'm talking to that's saying something like that, their view of energy is wrong. I don't know what energy is. No physicist knows what energy is, but I can tell you exactly. I can tell you exactly how to deal with it or exactly how much we understand it. And that's energy is a scalar quantity that is conserved in interactions. That's it. That's all I can tell you about energy, but I can demonstrate that that's what energy is. I can demonstrate effectively and repeatedly that that's what energy is. What you are telling me cannot be demonstrated.
And what are they? I mean, what's their point of view?
That energy is some sort of knowledgeable force. That energy has some sort of power to it beyond that. That things can contain energy that people can then access in some other way, like crystals have energy, or people have auras.
So they're not thinking about energy the same way you're defining energy, then, right?
They're making something up, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, sure, but you have a very clear definition of energy, and it does not agree with their definition of energy.
Right.
Right? Their energy is, you said an aura, right?
Right.
And to me, those are... a scientist talking about energy and a hippie talking about an aura. Sorry. But, you know.
No, it's true. No,
I'm just
true.
Making a point. You know, yeah. I'm just being a little disingenuous by to make the point is they're not defining the same thing. They might have some similar properties, but the aura is not just. So I'm not going to say it doesn't. I'm not going to say it's hocus pocus, right? It depends on, because I'm not sure exactly what we're defining. But energy is energy. It is a quantum that.
It's not a quantum.
Oh, okay.
It's a quantity. It's a scalar quantity.
Scalar.
So the difference between a vector and a scalar, once again, is a vector has a direction and scalar just don't. Right.
So I, you know, you can tell me if there's an egg. I mean, it's probably not the perfect thing, but it is. No, because that's going to reuse the word energy. So you can't really define energy by saying it's energy.
Yeah.
But
that's why the definition that I gave, which is a scalar quantity that is conserved interaction, is so
that is. Telling
it,
that
it
is,
doesn't tell you much. It really it no. doesn't say much about it at all. But I can demonstrate that.
Sure, but their energy means so. Their
it's the same thing with time. So I can't tell you what time is. I can demonstrate that point A, point B. There's something of there's a quantity between those that we call time. I can't tell you what that is. So time and energy are the same in that way. Right. I can't tell you what that is.
What I'm saying is if you talk to your friend, right, you could probably come to a reasonable agreement about your energy. The thing that does work, right? Uh-huh. The thing that makes that comes out of batteries, the things that comes out of the sun, that energy. They're overloading the term energy with aura and
right.
other spiritual crap, right? And I think you could come to an agreement about your energy and have them use a different word. When they're talking to you, have them use a different word for their energy.
It's
and then
because...
you can have an argument about their energy.
Right. But it's hard because that term becomes used in the community, and then when it becomes so omnipresent, how do you deal with the telling them
stop
that,
smoking so much fucking pot, you hippie?
That's not the problem. Pot's not the problem. Pot can help you think in strange ways and can help you think clearly.
That's not what I meant. I know.
But
who talks about their? You have a really good energy, man.
This is
hippies do.
Not my friend. My friend doesn't do that. Not that I would reject a friend who does talk like that, but that's not his point. But his point is more that he kind of questions the most basic assumptions we make.
We talked about this friend previously, I believe.
Then. Yeah, and I'm not willing to go that far. And the reason why is because A, I don't see a reason to, and B, I don't see a point to it. And this goes back to the simulation argument. Okay, it's vaguely possible if I grant you X, Y, Z, blah, 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 blah. But why should I grant you X, Y, Z, blah, 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 blah? What is your reason behind me assuming these things? Mm-hmm. I'll assume so much as the evidence takes me, but I won't assume past that. I won't assume strongly past that. I won't assume 8 steps past that. Sure. I may go 1 or 2, but I'm not going to go 12 past. I'm not going to go into that, and that. What if all these things are true? Well, that's ridiculous. I'll accept what if this is true, and what if this is true, and therefore this is true. I'll go probably that far, but I won't go any further.
I don't know.
Neither do I.
I can't play devil's
That's
advocate.
That's the whole point.
I can't play devil's advocate
but I think,
anymore.
I think that the thing is that you and I are comfortable with that, with the idea that I don't know. I'll experiment. I'll test. But I don't know. But a lot of people are not comfortable with
that. Oh, sure. I mean, we talked early on, right, where, it would sure be nice to have this omniscience after you die. This heaven omniscience thing. Sure be nice. If it happens, super duper. I don't expect it to.
It'd be nice if you had it, but you also had the option of ending it. Because I can't think of a worse hell than living forever.
Yeah, worry about that when you get there. Because you're not going to get there.
No. I suppose not. But, you know, it's like, I you know, living forever in bliss or in hell, they both seem
to... Well, I mean, we talked before, like, you know, I don't know. I mean, I think that's... we're really rehashing old stuff. I really don't want to rehash old stuff. But
not everybody listens to every single show. It's okay.
Yeah. I just feel like the people that are an hour and 5 minutes in the post show know this thing, right?
But it's interesting, so it's okay to talk about. We don't have to come up with novel things every single time. We can retread a topic or two.
I mean, it goes back. Okay, so what I'm thinking about is, you know, the conversation I had with my sister where, you know, she was shocked that I didn't believe in heaven because I didn't want to see my wife and kids after I died. And I'm like, really? I couldn't fathom.
Yeah.
I couldn't fathom the whole, wait, you think heaven's a family reunion in the sky?
Or even
that's, I mean, even my thoughts of heaven were nothing like a family reunion in the sky.
But I think even the point, the ultimate point, which is that it doesn't matter what you want. It's how things are. What you want makes no difference. If you, you know, you could want things all you want, but that doesn't make a damn bit of difference.
Like, what I want is I would love, you know, the perfect universe for me would be to...
The perfect universe is infinite novelty. If you had infinite consciousness, then you'd want infinite novelty. You want to be constantly be... having new things happen.
All I want is I want to die. I want to have a moment of omniscience to see what the human race achieves. And then I'll be gone. That'd be awesome, wouldn't it? Wouldn't it be awesome to see what, you know, what happens?
Yeah.
To see the end of the movie. Wouldn't you want to see the end
of
the movie?
Yes.
I don't want to live forever in paradise.
Right.
I just want to see the end of the movie.
No, it's like I said, it's that Hitchens quote that I've said 5 or 6 times at least on the show, which is that, you know, because he was dying of cancer, and he says, the worst part is not someone telling you the party's ending. The worst part is somebody telling you the party's going to keep going. You're just not invited anymore. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's the idea that... And that's
I don't want to make up any other bullshit around it to stay around. I, you know, it'd be so cool to die, watch the end of the movie, human race peters out with a nuclear war, human race makes it to stars. You know, show me what happens, and I'll be gone, never to be heard from again.
Mm-hmm.
That would be a dream come true to die and to see to have that happen, right?
Yeah, and that's sort of, you know, what I talked about the Lawrence Krauss thing. He says he got into cosmology to find out what the end of the universe is. And, you know, he says, and I found out, and I forget what quote.
Cold, dark, lonely place.
Well, this quote was from, I think it was from Kurt Vonnegut, which was something along the lines of, there's always more and it's always worse. It's only going to get worse. And that's was sort of the point of his lecture, that, you know, this is what's going to happen, and it's not pretty. But, you know, not pretty for us. But that doesn't mean anything, really.
Right.
We're looking at it from a very, very particular angle, from a very particular scale. If you wanted to make a universe that was extremely adept at making black holes, then our universe would be a fine choice. And we are just a tiny little, like, dirt that's part of the startup sequence.
Sure. No, I mean, I don't... Everyone's living in a special place, and I think that I'm not everyone. I think I'm perfectly fine with my spot in the universe.
Okay, I think we will leave you on that contemplative thought.
That works. I stopped because I was about to repeat myself, and I didn't want to do that, so that's why I kind of just stopped.
So what's really going to bug you, if I can before you end, what's really going to bug you is when Allison starts asking you, well, how does the battery work? How does the battery deliver energy? And that's a complicated question. You can go very easy, but that gets really, really hard.
How does the battery work?
Yeah.
Oh, I would tell her that there's two dissimilar materials that cause an electric charge.
Why?
How? Why? Because, maybe not 100% accurate, but at least leading her down the inquisitive trail of truthiness is that there is a differential in energy, and there is the more there's ions on one side that want to get to the other side, so they want to flow. And because there's an insulator in the battery, it has to flow externally, so it goes through the wires.
Inside the battery, so it has to flow externally. Right. Right, okay, yeah. So, because you can just connect a battery to itself, but it's separated chemically.
There's an insulator there. Otherwise, it would flow internal instead of out the positive terminal and in the negative terminal. I might have more knowledge about batteries than the average Joe. I mean, one of my science projects was cutting a battery open and learning how they worked. So
I remember dry cells. Remember those guys? Big
dry cells.
Yeah, big batteries that are about the size of this.
You mean like lantern batteries?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, about this tall with the two springy things on top?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's one of the ones I cut open. They're hard to cut open. Yeah, I cut them open at an angle, at diagonal, so you could see the anode and the cathode. But so you have the anode and the cathode, and they're in a material.
Electrolyte solution, basically.
Right, right. So, I've cut open a few batteries I guess that was middle school or junior high. I remember, like I said, I don't remember all the details. I'm definitely filling in the gaps with my current knowledge of how electricity works. Also, one of my coolest science experiments, I did jet engines. So I made this little steam jet engine. So I had this, little wooden platform with that little tea light candle on it. And then I had a metal container over top of it and had water in there with a little hole poked in the back, which is the nozzle, right? So when it started boiling, it was on almost like a mobile, right? So it was on a balanced pen, thing. So it would actually spin around in circles. The candle would make the thing go and... So, yeah, that was just a little science project on jet engines, and then a little bit of a report on the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. I don't think that report was very good because the JPL isn't really about jet propulsion.
I mean, like the JPL does the Mars rovers and stuff like that.
I mean, this was back in the 80s, but I'm guessing my report wouldn't have passed much muster against someone
against the bees team from that other school.
Yeah, because I mean that was it. Like I remember, even NASA has a jet propulsion laboratory or something. That's how I worked it in, just the name, right?
Jets. It's sort of like my mom has a thing where
with jets you think fire, but really it's just directed pressure.
Yeah, it's just directed pressure. And that my mother doesn't like getting in any plane that has a propeller. And she wants jets, not propeller. I'm like, well, a jet is just a propeller inside of a contraption. That's all it is.
Well, it's a propeller and an explosion instead of just a propeller.
Right, but I mean...
The combustion happens on the blades instead of in a combustion chamber.
Right, yeah. So, it's not that much different. It's more efficient for when you get into larger sizes, it scales. But the propeller's fine. The propeller works great. The propeller was the beginnings of aviation for like, what, 40, 50 years, propellers were folks of aviation.
You know, a cylinder engine's fine for your car. Why not for your airplane, yeah. Right?
And what, the B-52 that we still use uses propellers?
No, B-52 is jet. The
C-130 B-2 is jet, but...
The B-52 is a jet.
Okay.
The C-130 is a propeller.
Okay. Yeah, the cargo planes, yeah.
No, Galaxy. I think the Galaxy is a different call number. C-3 or something like that. I don't think it's C-130.
Some cargo plane.
Yeah, no, the AC-130, the Scepter, the gunship, yeah. And then I forget the Hercules. The Hercules is the C-130. Those are propeller.
Yeah.
No, the last propeller bomber was, was probably slightly after World War II. B-52 is definitely jet. It has like 4 or maybe 6 jet engines.
Okay, I'll accept that.
Or 8 jet engines. It has dual pod jet engines, right?
Yeah.
Remember, you have to defer to me for military things.
Absolutely.
I kick your ass in the military knowledge.
I know there are military planes with jets and with propellers. I know that they're and sure. C-130s
cargo, some cargo stuff and trainers, of course.
Yeah, because you're looking for it's an efficiency curve that sort of it spikes early and it spikes late in terms of where propellers are good, and then jets are sort of in the middle in terms of efficiency.
If only we had a tool to tell me what the last propeller bomber was, the B-50 bomber. So you were close. B-50 looks a lot like the B-29.
Yes, there you go.
An awful lot like the B-29. Yeah. I'm not familiar with the B-50, but this picture, I'm like, if I saw that picture blind, I'm like, oh, that's the B-29 that the kind of plane they use to drop the atomic bombs.
Right.
So,
we'll click on the link for B-52. Show me B-52. It's right there. Just click on that.
Okay.
Hypertext. Yeah.
B-52 looks a lot different. Swept wings. Mm-hmm. It has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 8 jet engines. I was watching I was watching that Nova show about the drones and whatnot.
Yeah.
And
you see the stealth drone? Looks like a little mini B-2. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. There was two things about the drone show. The first thing. We're gonna extend this post show because I want to talk about this shit. First part was that the SR-71 is still being flown.
What, the Blackbird?
Blackbird. I thought it was retired, but
so did I. This is a stealth drone.
Yeah,
that's awesome. Look how big it is too.
Yeah,
it's huge.
Actually, no, I'm not sure I saw that one, but that's pretty wild. They still fly the SR-70. Or no, they don't fly the SR-71. They still fly the U-2.
Oh, the U-2, yes, I knew that was still in it.
The U-2, the one that Gary Powers got shot down in the 52.
Like 70,000 feet.
They still
above,
fly the U-2. I was stunned to feel that they're still
the
using
cool
that.
Thing. I remember reading about the SR-71, and there were some really cool things about it. Like, for instance, the fuel container on there was
well the skin would expand and get so hot during flight that there was no like plastic sealant that could withstand the temperatures. So when it's sitting on the tarmac, fuel will leak out the gaps of the skin.
So they had to take off and immediately refuel in flight before they could go.
Well, when it was flying, the skin would heat up and it would seal up the gas tanks.
Yep, exactly. So this, what they had to do is because so much would leak out.
I didn't know about the immediately refuel part.
They had to take off, immediately refuel when the tank was
Took off with like almost no gas, right? Because they didn't want a whole bunch of gas leaking out, when, sparks could happen, mm-hmm. right? So maybe they took off with an empty, empty tank or something like that. I didn't know about that, but yeah, I knew about the leaking part. But yeah, they still fly the U-2s, which I found stunning. And then there was the other part.
It's a efficient and useful design that that was the thing about the SR-71. It's completely inefficient. It was ridiculously inefficient design. But it worked for what it was. But the B-52 was it's an efficient design that works. And when things work. That's just evolution for you. If something works and there's nothing better that really comes along,
And then the other part was they're talking about this new, still classified camera system that they have on a drone. They're talking about how it captures rated at 1.8 gigapixel and creates 1 million terabytes of data a day and is kept forever. It takes a 25 square mile continuous picture from 20,000 feet. And they showed the demonstration of this camera thing. I forget what I don't have it here what it was called. You'll be able to find it. But I did the math. I looked at the math. 1 million terabytes a day from one plane. The LHC only collects 1 terabyte a second, which is only 86,400 terabytes a day at the sensors. This is for Atom. And only a fraction of that. Atlas. Atlas. Only a fraction of that is written to the storage. So how do they keep a million terabytes a day? You know how much storage, how many hard drives that is?
Well, I can imagine how that happens, because the thing is that you're talking about inverse femtobarns when you're talking about the LHC. You're talking about data collection, sure, but ultimately you're talking about not a lot of data for.
But no, this is video. This is 1 million terabytes of video surveillance.
Yeah, exactly. The video is a lot more information. Video is 24 to 30 frames a second of. I'm sure a large pixel rate. You know how big these.
How can an airplane capture 11.5 terabytes a second?
11.5 terabytes a second?
Yes, that's 1 million terabytes a day. 11.5 terabytes a second. How does it capture that and transfer it anywhere over radio?
How does it transmit it? I don't know. How does it capture it? Military technology is probably at least 10 to 15 years ahead of where we are. I'm not surprised they don't have some very interesting ways of collecting information. How does it transmit? God, I have no idea, because you're reaching physical limits when you're talking about transmitting that sort of data.
Yes, it's insane. And I did some more research. Atlas does the... So the CMS experiment is what collects 1 terabyte a second at the sensors. The Atlas experiment collects 66 terabytes a second at the sensors, but only stores 18 gigabytes a minute.
Right, because so almost every single event is thrown out, because otherwise the energy density is the information density is too huge. They won't be able to keep it all.
Yeah, so 66 terabytes a second is more than this airplane, but it only stores 18 gigs a minute, where this would store 11.5 terabytes a second.
Must throw a lot of it out, the same way the Atlas does. That's the only way
it says they can make it's sense. Stored forever. They said on the Nova show that it takes 1 million terabytes a day and is kept forever.
You said 1 million terabytes a day.
1 million terabytes a day. 11.5 terabytes a second.
So is that a petabyte?
That is terabyte. Exabyte.
Exabyte.
Well, it's almost an exabyte because there's the whole 1024 thing.
Yeah, yeah.
1 petabyte is 1,024 terabytes.
Okay, yeah.
Exabyte is 1,024 right. petabytes.
So 1,000 terabytes is an exabyte, and 1,000,000 would be...
Well, 1,000...
1,000 is a petabyte.
1,024. So right, it's a little less than an exabyte.
Yeah, okay. That's a lot of information, geez.
It's stored in a day and kept forever. Like, I was trying to find research on how much storage was sold... from storage manufacturers in 2012, and I could only find something that was like 4 or 5 years old, and who knows what the ramp up rate is on storage, right? I mean, you can buy 4 terabyte hard drives now. So, but even if you're buying 4 terabyte hard drives, you would need 3 of those a second. How do you know how long it takes to copy data to a 4 terabyte hard drive? It takes like 4 days to copy to a 4 terabyte.
Well, not even that, but then you're dealing with, again, an NP hard problem of searching through all that information.
Yeah. Okay, so, you know, the biggest hard drive I have is a 2 terabyte. If I wanted to write and fill that hard drive up, I would expect it would take... Uh, 20 hours, maybe 30 hours.
Well, then again, though, I mean, if you go under the assumption that military technology is about 15 years ahead of where we are, then years ago you would have said,
okay, so
you would
okay.
have had
there's that
a 20 megabyte hard drive or
and
like that.
Put it in a small airplane. That is way beyond 20 years.
No, not necessarily. Because 15, you know, if you take today's stuff and you go 15 years ago, I would have a screen with this kind of resolution
put that
and this color depth and this kind of space in this tiny frame
with this kind of battery life. You put too much credit in military technology. If you're thinking it's that kind of, if it's 15 years, that's, I don't know. Maybe I'm ignorant, but.
I think that in, you know, we don't learn about the stuff that's in military technology until well beyond its, you know, its after date. You know, we didn't learn about the B-2 until well
but
beyond.
But the avionics on the B-2,
we still don't know.
The computer software, no, the, like the avionics on like the F-117 and stuff, it's not. Maybe I don't know that. Never mind. I'll step back. I'm thinking of like the space shuttle and shit. Damn beer. Who makes the storage? I can't imagine that there's a whole industry making this storage that is top secret. Maybe I'm ignorant, right? But it just seems.
What do you think they're doing at Area 51? Aliens? No. They're doing fucking information shit. Not only that, but they're also feeding you bad numbers.
I do think these are impossible numbers. Yeah. 11.5 terabytes a second from an airplane?
It's the same thing as the Iranian plane. It's just a different scale.
Yeah, I think...
They're feeding you silly numbers because it's just like when...
I can't believe Nova ran with these numbers. The numbers are just implausible.
But you know what it's like? It's like when the U.S. made SEAL Team 6... Why was SEAL Team 6 called SEAL Team 6? Because they didn't want to say they only had two SEAL teams. They wanted you know, the other countries to think that they had, wow, they have six of them, even more than that maybe? No, it was only their second SEAL team, but they called them SEAL Team 6 because they knew that that would probably get escape, but they wanted that number to be out there. So they wanted that number to be out there. Is that what they're doing? Probably not. Is that close to what they're doing? It's probably within a reasonable ballpark.
Number boggles the mind. You're on a flying, you're on a small aircraft, you know, small autonomous.
They're not that
aircraft.
Small. I mean, you get the idea. The predator
only weighs 2,000 pounds. It's only like 20 feet long. It's a small airplane. It's tiny. It's smaller than a Cessna.
But you don't have to have any room for pressurization equipment, any room for you know, cockpit, oxygen, nothing like that. You have no room for avionics with displays, nothing.
I understand that. But the...
And they're still huge. They're still huge planes. 20 feet's a big. 20 feet's a lot of plane. So it's not... It's not little, you know, little remote control plane they're flying out there. It's a relatively big plane. It's still considerably bigger than
but
you.
But if you wanted to write...
It's still larger than a Cessna. And it doesn't have any cockpit, doesn't have any design for anything other than just the electronics that are in there and the stuff to make it fly.
So top secret technology versus commercially available technology. You want to write 1 terabyte a second, let alone 11.5 terabytes a second. You're talking about a data center bigger than my basement.
For what you have. And what you can buy off the market, you know,
which you can buy off the market, the most expensive enterprise grade storage, try a terabyte a second.
Right.
You know, it's the size of my basement, and they're flying something that can do 11.5 times that. I'm skeptical that the military has that kind of technology.
The number's probably inflated, but it's you know, I would not be surprised by 2 or 3 at least on that size. Sure.
Okay. I mean, that's just the thing. The numbers, I can't believe Nova didn't try to fact check those numbers and ran with them. They just seem absurd.
It's sort of like, though, when Microsoft says, you know, this will work on this, or, you know, you'll get this many frames per second on this sort of machine. And it's like, okay, that's theoretical. Really, cut that in half.
It just bugs me. It bugs you the same way that
incomplete scientific explanations bug me. But it's one of those things that, you know, you got to deal with. When
incomplete scientific explanations will have more scientists to do shit like this in the future. So than you scaring everyone away and doing retail and service jobs.
Well, I'm just I what matters to me is what's actually going on, not a unreasonable facsimile of what's really going on. So that's where I get to it, and not everyone is interested in the subject the way I am. Not everyone wants to know how things work to the same depth that I do. I can accept that. I think we've done it.
I think that's good. Yes.
A long show.
So one of the guys at work sent that quote about that system that was taking all that surveillance about the storage and whatnot, and I replied with my objection, my skepticism to the numbers. No one took me up on the conversation. I was so bummed.
Yeah, it is a bummer. Like when I remember when I did the microwave thing. When
Damien didn't even reply, a jerk.
Well, I've messaged you sometimes. You didn't reply to my thing. So sometimes you take the bait and sometimes you don't. But it reminds me of when, they put that microwave thing on in my thing. That if you use this microwave and the toaster at the same time, it will throw the earth out of, off the orbit of the sun. And so I calculated what that was and I put it on there. And I was hoping for somebody to be like, huh, how'd you come up with that? No one asked. No one even bothered to ask what that was.
Bummer.
Yeah. But I was like, I gotta know what that is. I gotta know what kind of energy you're talking about. That's just me. I'm weird. Deal with it.
All right. Let's wrap this up.
Yeah.
It's 1 o'clock. Oh, boy. My kids are gonna be up soon.
Yeah. So I've got here at, 6:30? So it's been 6.5 hours.
All right, we'll see you next time.
See ya.